This is Dr. Richard Verona conducting an oral history interview with John R. Ron Milam. Today is June 27th, 2005. It's approximately 1:41 p.m. Central Standard Time. And Ron and I are in the Special Collections Library building on the campus of Texas Tech University. And we're conducting an interview for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project. Ron, why don't we start with some biographical data on yourself? Could you tell me when you were born and where you're from?
I was born November 5th, 1945. I was born in San Diego, California, my father was an ensign in the Navy. I was born at North Island Hospital in Coronado.
Okay. Ron, I forgot, of course, let me ask you, I need to do the disclaimer that we discussed at length before the interview. By doing this interview, you were consenting to release this interview to the Vietnam Archive as a donation, as you would a collection or a material object, and that we will have this interview in our possession to make available to the public for research or whatever methods. The interview will be in transcript and audio form. It'll be here in the archive on CD or future medium, whatever that might be, and will then be also made available to the public via the internet on the virtual Vietnam Archive. Do you consent to this interview and to the release of the information to the public?
Yes, I do.
And with the caveat that if at some point in the future you feel like you need to withdraw the interview in time, we as the archive will agree to do so at your wishes. Okay, so continuing, born in San Diego in 1945, right there on the West Coast after the war's over.
Yes.
So tell me about your parents.
My father was in the was in the Navy. He was an officer. He was a supply officer. And he had been in, I believe he'd been in for about a year and a half before the war ended. And so, yes, I was born just a couple of months after the fall of Japan.
How about your mother?
My mother was a housewife, and I had an older sister that was born right before me, so she was living out there, and as I recall, and of course these stories have been told to me since as I was growing up, but my father was on the part of the planned invasion of Japan.
Wow.
That never happened, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got out of the Navy immediately as soon as the war was over. But I guess I was a Navy brat for 6 months or so.
Okay. So you had one older sister?
One older sister, and then I had a brother born later on, my brother is 6 years younger than I am.
Okay. What are their names?
My sister is Judy mm-hmm. Carr, K-A-R-R.
Is that J-U-D-Y?
Yes.
Okay.
And my brother is Mike Milam.
Okay. Tell me, how would you describe your father? What do you remember about your dad?
My father was, I always remember my father as being a real patriot, very much a supporter of the United States, of our country and most of our foreign policy efforts. Growing up, we lived out here, not too far from here, in Oklahoma,
mm-hmm.
and he was in the oil and gas business. He was worked his way up from being at the very lowest levels of the company all the way up to retiring as a vice president. So he was started out as a blue collar worker, although he was a college graduate, the first one in our family. And then he worked his way up and retired as an officer of the company. He was second generation oil and gas person, and I was the third.
Okay. How about your mother? What was she like? How do you remember her?
My mom was a very loving mother. I think I would describe her as being a kind of, you might say, a typical mother of the 50s. That's my memory of as a child. She didn't work in the business world, but she sure worked at home. She was. When you think back on it now, she was worked as hard as most women who later on in life would have jobs. But she was the mother of three children, and she stayed at home, and she took care of the house, and she looked after all of the things that were important to us as kids.
Yeah. Okay. How long were you all in San Diego?
Just for, I believe, 6 months.
Okay.
Until the war ended. Well, the war had already ended, but I was born in November, and I think we were just there for a couple of more months.
Okay, and where did you all move?
We moved then, I believe we moved to Chicago.
Okay.
My father began a career in the oil and gas business, and I think we moved up to Chicago, and then he had a series of moves. I say he was in the oil and gas business. He was in the natural gas business, and he was involved in a pipeline business, the Natural Gas Pipeline Company of America, and it started out here in Oklahoma and West Texas, and went to Chicago. So we went to Chicago first, and then we moved from Chicago to out to here, and then we, about every 3 years or so, we would move north to a different location on the pipeline.
Okay.
So I moved a lot when I was a kid.
What do you remember about all those moves? Was that difficult for you?
Well, I always thought my dad was being promoted in all those moves. I'm not sure he was. They seemed like they were promotions, but we were moving to different locations. I remember none of it ever bothered me. It was exciting to move to a different place. Living in western Oklahoma as a child, I kind of grew up with cowboys and Indians concepts, and I enjoyed all of that. And then as we would move further north, whatever we did, we just did. I don't remember it really bothering me. It was just part of growing up.
Okay. About your brother and sister, were they?
I think it bothered my older sister a lot. I think she, because maybe she was older, or maybe because she was a girl, it was harder for her to make the adjustments. At least I remember my parents saying it was harder for her. Maybe I didn't notice it as much as they did, but I remember hearing those things. And my brother was so young, I don't think it made much difference. But I think it probably made me value friendships, because you knew you may have them for a short period of time and then they'd be gone when you move. But it seems like I knew that we were always going to move again. I don't remember thinking, well, this is it, we'll stay here forever, at least up until I was a teenager.
Okay. Well, describe how you were as a young boy. How would you describe yourself? This is your pre-high school, pre-junior high. What were you like?
Well, I remember liking to do adventurous things, and I think my parents have told me since then that I was always involved in active things, riding my bike and playing soldier and doing all the things that young boys do. It was a pre-television time. We didn't have a television set until I was 10 or 11 years old, so I didn't know what the rest of the world was doing in terms of entertainment and those kinds of things. But I remember living out here in western Oklahoma, the big thing was playing soldier and playing cowboys and Indians. Did that a lot as a child.
Okay. Were you a reader? Did you like to read?
I liked to read, but I don't have great memories of reading. I think it was just sort of a natural thing. I'm sure I did, and I can remember the things that I read were always adventurous things. I still have some of those books that my parents bought me that about Custer and about Davy Crockett, and this was Davy Crockett even before there was a Walt Disney Davy Crockett, and Amelia Earhart, and everything that I liked to read was always about somebody that had done something that was adventurous.
Okay. What about sports? Were you mentioned the Cowboys and Indians thing, but what about more organized?
Yeah, there was. I don't remember being real interested in spectator sports, because living out in western Oklahoma, we had a football team that played six man. We didn't watch television. I remember listening to fights on the radio with my father. But I don't, and I remember going to rodeos as a young child, but I don't remember, and I played baseball. But that was about it, because there really wasn't the era of spectator sports for football and basketball and baseball. That didn't come later for me until I was almost a teenager, because we didn't live where we had televisions.
Right.
So, but I did. I did participate. I remember being in track meets and things like that up until I was in before we moved back up north. But. Mm-hmm. But I always liked sports, but as a very young child, it was more a matter of the adventurous kinds of things, I think.
Okay. Well, as you grew older, tell me about how you developed. What kind of student were you? How much did you like school, sports, socially, things like that?
I remember in elementary school, there was... I remember getting really good grades for personality issues and things like that. I don't remember getting anything above average grades when it came to scholastic matters. We were graded on effort. And I remember they said I tried hard, or sometimes they said I could do better. But I always got good grades on not necessarily on achievement, but on participation, and I don't want to say I was a class clown exactly, but I was the kind of person that people did like to be around. And I remember liking school. I remember liking going to school. I don't ever remember thinking, gee, I wish summer would come so I didn't have to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember particularly liking being there because of the things I was learning as much as just being there with my friends. Mm-hmm. And doing school kind of things. Mm-hmm. That was more important than the actual scholastic achievement.
Okay. And getting into junior high school and high school, were you still moving every few years? Or
we moved up until I was 12 years old. We moved about every 3 years.
Okay.
By the time I got to be 12, we moved to Michigan. And I didn't know it at the time that we would be there for the rest of my life, pretty much. But I did, but we were. We didn't make another move after that.
Okay. And so you were able to basically go through junior high school, high school in one locale?
Yes.
Okay. Where in Michigan were you?
We moved to a town called Dearborn, Michigan, home of the Ford Motor Company. Mm-hmm. We moved there when I was, I believe, starting the sixth or seventh grade, and then we stayed there through my I stayed there through high school, and went to college in Michigan, same area.
Okay. What kind of student were you in junior high and high school?
I wasn't a great student. I was an average student. I was an average student in terms of my grades, but I participated in everything. By that time, I had become an athlete. I participated in cross country, track, tennis. I was president of my 10th grade class. I was on the student council. I sang in the choirs, the men's glee club, the concert choir. I was in the school plays. If you could do it, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
My grades were, I was a B student, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall that I was particularly, I wasn't a great student by any stretch.
What was your favorite subject? And your least favorite subject?
My favorite subject was political, was called civics.
Right.
Now we call it government or political science.
Mm-hmm.
But it was it was about politics. If it was about politics, I was interested. History was never interesting to me because I don't recall ever having a good history teacher in high school, someone that really made me interested. But I had good government and civics teachers, and so I was getting my interest in history through political science.
Okay. Why so much interest in politics?
I don't know for sure, but I think my father was always a very active political person. He was always, not so much being local, being in politics, but just, we talked about it all the time at home. When the conventions were on, before they were on television, we listened to them on the radio, and then when they were on television from 1960 on, I never missed a political convention, and I watched all of the political conventions, Republican and Democrat. I was very interested in that.
About your brother and sister, were they the same? Or
no, they weren't interested in either one of those things that I recall. I was a little bit different than they were.
Was this a bonding thing between you and your dad?
I think so.
Yeah.
And it still is. We still talk politics all the time.
Sounds like a great warm memories of sitting by the radio or watching the television, watching speeches.
We always watched speeches. And we would talk about them. It was very much a part of our life, of the political world.
Do you want to talk about, you know, where your father and your family stood on the political spectrum? And were you all more Democrat or Republican? I mean, of course, it's changed a bit since then.
Yeah.
As far as how we see Democrats, Republicans, or how the world does.
But my father was a very strong Republican. My father was, was not even very much a supporter of Franklin Roosevelt. I remember him, he was from Kansas, and I think he voted for Alf Landon. maybe the only one outside of Kansas. My father was very much a rugged individualist, somebody who believed in entrepreneurial spirit. He was never one to believe that it was important in life that you form organizations to take on the establishment. That wasn't something that he was about. He was about forming, about personal responsibility. He was about accepting responsibility for your mistakes in life and going on with them, not blaming others for your things that you should have figured out on your own. And I think he saw some of the change in the New Deal when the New Deal came in 1932. I think he saw some of that as trying to have government take over the responsibilities of the individual. Mm-hmm. And so I think he rejected some of that. Although I think he had respect for the President of the United States as his Commander-in-Chief when he was in the service. Mm-hmm. But I think that was different than what he saw the President Roosevelt being insofar as his role in domestic policy.
Okay.
So I guess you could say I was raised in a somewhat of a Republican household. On the other hand, my father had great respect for the office of the president, and even if he didn't vote for that person, he respected them for the role they were in. He also would be very upset if somebody violated the trust the American people had put in that person, and I think he was critical, for example, of some of the President Johnson's role in Vietnam. He was very critical of Nixon's role in Watergate, even though it was a different party.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he could find anyone he's ever been critical of, it would be because of the way they perceived their role in that job. On the other hand, I would never classify my father as a right-wing conservative, because he was very critical of a lot of the things that presidents did who were considered right-wingers. He was not an extremist in any sense of the word. Very respectful of people's rights, people's civil liberties, and all those kinds of things. But basically, he believed in the independence of the American people and their desire to do things that were and do them on their own, and not necessarily need organizations mm-hmm. to help them, and not a joiner in that sense of believing that the answer to America's problems is through labor unions and those kinds of things.
Right, right. What about your mother? Was she into politics?
I don't remember my mother ever taking an active role in discussions about political matters. I remember her being supportive of our ideas and things, but not actively engaging in a lot of those discussions. She was a very loving mother who helped us with anything that we needed, but I don't remember her taking those kinds of active roles in those kinds of discussions. But I come from a family where my father talked a lot, and you can mm-hmm. see I do too, so my mother, it was hard for my mother to get a word in anyways.
Did you all talk as a family about these issues or not?
Yes, we did. We actually ate dinner together. We ate supper together. And talked about political matters. Usually we would start dinner with listening to the news on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and then we would all have comments about those things.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. Tell me about you in high school as far as you did participate in sports. You continued
yes.
to do this. Did you see value in, and obviously I mean, it was fun for you, mm-hmm. But did you see some value in team sports and going that route with a lot of your focus?
Yes, I enjoyed, I participated in, I was on the cross country team and the tennis team. Those are my two varsity sports. And those were both individual sports. I wasn't big enough to play football, and I played baseball, but not on the high school teams. But I did enjoy tennis, and I did enjoy running, so those were considered individual things.
You still play tennis or run?
I still jog and run, yeah,
yeah.
After all my life, pretty much. Yeah, I don't play as much tennis as I should.
Okay.
And I began to play golf in those days, and I still play golf, but I never played on the golf team.
Okay. What was your least favorite subject? You mentioned history. You weren't really enthralled by it because of you
yeah.
a good teacher, but were there subjects that you just really did not want to do?
I was not real fond of math, and I wasn't real fond of physics. I liked biology, I believe. But I liked the social sciences. I liked sociology and psychology. Those were just subjects that were just starting to be taught at the high school level mm-hmm. back in the 60s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really enjoyed those kinds of subjects because they dealt with people. I was much more involved in the people aspect of education than I was the thing aspect of education, being the maths and the sciences. I tolerated those kinds of things, but I didn't enjoy them very much.
How were your parents concerning your education? Were they encouraging you to go to school, do your homework? Were they kind of focused that on that for you and your sister and your brother? Or was it something that was really left up to the kids?
I think in my family, my father was a college graduate. He graduated from University of Kansas in 1936. And my mother graduated from a community college a couple of years before that, Butler County Community College in Kansas. And that was unusual to have parents that were both had both gone to college. So we were always, it was just always understood that all of us would go to college.
Is that a problem?
No, I think I just bought into that and said, yeah, I knew this was what I would do. The particular high school that I went to was a middle class high school, but it was a lot. I would say not even 50% of my high school class would go on to college. Mm-hmm. A lot of them would go on to work in the plants in the mm-hmm. Ford Motor Company plants there in Dearborn. But I understood that it was my job and my role in life to go to college. No question about it. And and it was always reinforced that that would be what my destiny would be.
Okay. How were you socially in high school? How would you describe yourself?
I was involved in, as I said, I was involved in school government. I was a president of my class. I was involved in student council. I was on every committee to do anything. I was very active socially.
Did you see politics as a future profession for you?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what did you have in mind?
I didn't know for sure, but I knew I'd run for something, and I ended up doing that, sir.
Okay. Right. How would you describe Dearborn? What do you remember about Dearborn?
I remember Dearborn as being a very... Ford Motor Company town, It was a one horse town in that sense. My dad didn't work for them, but my wife, my girlfriend, my future wife's father did. And most everyone I knew's dad worked for the Ford Motor Company. It was a town of a lot of Middle Easterners, Lebanese as we called them then, but they may have been from anywhere in the Middle East that were there working in the Ford plant. It was a very white town, very segregated town. And I don't even know if that's the right word, segregated, because there were no African Americans that lived in the town, and it was kind of known for that. It had a mayor who was very famous for trying to make sure that Dearborn, Michigan stayed white. I don't remember that being a big issue because our football team and our basketball team and that sort of thing all played sports against schools that were either integrated or that were totally segregated the other way, mm-hmm. that were all black, and we participated in a league of that sort of thing. But I do remember that it was a very white town. Now, as I rub shoulders with other people that grew up in other parts of the country, that's not as unusual as at the time that I thought it might be. There was a lot of segregated towns in America in the 60s. But I do remember that we had an all-white school.
What years were you there in high school?
I went to high school from 1960 and graduated in 1963.
Was there any kind of resentment, or was Ford Motor Company looked upon as a really good thing because it was the economy of the city?
You know, it was looked upon as a very good thing. We had the best school system in the state of Michigan, and it was because the Ford Motor Company paid so much money in property taxes that our property tax burden was low. The Ford Motor Company donated land for the parks and recreation programs. They donated for the swimming pools. It was a great place to grow up because the Ford Motor Company was so active in making sure that its employees had a good place to live.
Do you drive a Ford today, Ron?
Yes, I do, as a matter of fact, and pretty much have been a Ford Motor Company person, even though my wife ended up working for General Motors, but I think there's something that stayed with her even. And yes, we do drove by Fords. In fact, at times we've driven two Fords.
That was a bit tongue-in-cheek.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, so you met Maxine there in Dearborn in high school?
Yes. She was the captain of the cheerleading squad, and I was an athlete, and she was a year ahead of me in school. But, yes, we started dating when we were, I guess I was 14 and she was 15, and we've dated ever since.
Wow. That's incredible.
It really is.
So how long until you guys knew that you were going to be married? Is this something that was like right after high school, or was this?
It was during high school.
And we do not have to talk about this, Ron. I know this is personal, but I wanted.
No, it's important in some ways because she's been a part of my life for my entire life. I would say that probably by the time we were 15 years old, we thought we'd get married someday. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We got married when I was 20. But I think probably by the time we were on the second or third date, we pretty much knew that that was going to be it. That's hard to explain, but that's the way we felt.
No, but if that's the way you felt, that's the way you felt, period.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter for anyone else. Now tell me about your family. How did they see Maxine and you know, that such a serious relationship at your age?
My family always loved her. They thought that from day one they liked her and probably thought that I could never do any better. Mm-hmm. My dad used to say, if you guys decide to get a divorce, I'm on her side. And that pretty much told me the way he felt about her. We were inseparable from the time we were 15 years old, and both sides knew that. I'm not sure that it was quite as the same way on her side of the family. There may have been a little bit of class distinction there that was difficult to get around because her father was a blue-collar tool and die worker, and mm-hmm. my dad was an executive in his business by that time, and we had a little bigger home and a little bigger home than they did, and so there may be a little cat class problem there, but later on I think that all went away.
Okay. Well, moving through high school, short-term questions about your military service and your ideas and going toward that. First, going back with your dad, did you all discuss his World War II experiences? And that, I imagine if you discussed politics, that had to play into the war period.
Yes. I don't remember too much about Korea because I would have been five to eight years old during the Korean War. I do remember someone from our little town. I was living in Hooker, Oklahoma, and then later in Mineola, Kansas, in the western part of Kansas and mm-hmm. western part of Oklahoma. And I remember that someone that worked for my father's son or someone they knew or something being killed in Korea. And I sort of remember that and people talking about it, but I don't remember making any political feeling about it. I do remember asking my dad what he did in the war, because I had a lot of friends whose fathers had served in World War II. And I had one particular friend, Wesley Blanchett, I think his name was. I don't know why that name sticks out in my mind, but and his father was had served in the Army and had actually been involved in D-Day. Wow. And so, and he would tell me these stories, and I can remember him.
Your friend's father.
Yes, my friend's father had been in D-Day, and I remember him telling me the stories that his father had told him, and so I would go home and ask my father, well, did you do this too, Dad? And my father said, no, he didn't do that. He was a supply officer. And I can remember in some way feeling disappointed at that, because my dad's my father hadn't fought the way Leslie's dad had fought. And I remember asking my dad one time about you must have carried a gun, didn't you? And him telling me that, yes, he carried a gun, but he only carried a gun when he, on payday, because he was paying the sailors when he'd go on board the ship. Uh-huh. And that was somewhat disappointing to me. In subsequent years, I realized how important everyone's role is in the military, and that such a small percentage of service men and now women ever actually fight in wars. Mm-hmm. But at the time, as a 6-7-year-old kid, I thought everybody that served fought.
Sure.
And how could my dad not fight when Leslie's dad had fought? That didn't. I don't say it bothered me, but it always was a point of curiosity to mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. But I do remember my father being very supportive of American efforts and whatever it was we were trying to do.
What are your earliest memories of American foreign policy, kind of being conscious of what we're doing in the world, the United States?
I remember the election of 1952, and I was only 7 years old, but I remember Eisenhower's having been elected, and I remember my father and mother being really happy about that. And I remember the Eichel solved the Korean War kind of talk around mm-hmm. the household. Mm-hmm. So my parents were fans of his. And that's probably the very earliest. And then through the 50s, I don't remember thinking much of, I wasn't as involved in, as active in the interest of Eisenhower's policies. That probably didn't come until 1960, until the election between Kennedy and Nixon. Mm-hmm. And I was very actively involved in that. I say active. I paid attention. I watched the conventions, paid a lot of attention to the Democratic Party's 1960 convention with Kennedy and Johnson, mm-hmm. and watched every minute of that election, of that campaign, primaries, everything. So that's probably the first time I really got interested.
Okay. Who did you support there in 68?
Supporting Richard Nixon.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you see,
my wife's family was all supporting John F. Kennedy.
Okay.
Dearborn was a very democratic town, because there were so many Ford workers, mm-hmm. and the Ford Motor Company was very active in supporting him and the workers, that is, because the union affiliation and that sort of thing. And I think even to a certain extent, of course, Robert McNamara ended up becoming the Secretary of Defense out of the Ford Motor Company.
Right.
So, but I do. I remember that election very specifically, and I was on the Republican side of it.
Do you remember anything about John Kennedy, uniqueness as a candidate? Or did you hear your mother talk about John Kennedy's uniqueness as a candidate?
No, I think there was a concern on the part of my family, along with a lot of other families that were strong Protestant families, that we were about to have our first Catholic president, and I think that concerned people, and I don't think my family was any exception to that, although I don't remember them ever saying it. I don't remember them being that bold in it, but I do remember that there were discussions about him being Catholic. I don't think it was so much that. I think it was more along the lines that he was very young, and we'd never had a president quite that young, at least in all of our lifetime, and that he was just a senator, and that Nixon had so much more experience having been a vice president. I think there was also a kind of a feeling in my family, at least, that Kennedy was from that Kennedy family, and there was, my dad knew a lot about Joe Kennedy and the way he'd earned his money and that sort of thing. And like I say, we were basically a Republican family, and this was a Democrat who. And there was also, I think, something to be said that my family was very much a supporter of Dwight Eisenhower, and in the process of running, Kennedy had to be, was very critical of the Eisenhower administration, the missile gap, all those kinds of things that were going on in that early part of the Cold War, and that here's this young sailor, or young, he'd been an officer, but he was a young Navy man, that's coming in and saying all these bad things about Ike. Because if you're saying those things about Ike, then you're attacking Richard Nixon, who was Ike's guy. So
right.
I think it was partly that, and I think as a, you know, what was I, 15, 16 years old at the time, I think I bought into my family's position on that.
How did you feel when Kennedy won?
And when?
How did you feel when Kennedy won the election? And I'm saying, kind of quotation marks, won the election.
Yeah, right. We still wonder about Illinois. I remember being very disappointed in Kennedy winning, because it just seemed to me that he, because I had listened to my parents so much, that this really spelled doom for the country. I don't remember why I thought it spelled doom, and I don't remember thinking anything about, you know, the nuclear issues or any of that. I think it was just that in my 16-year-old perspective at that moment, the American people had elected the wrong guy, and that all those successful things that Eisenhower had done were now going to go down the drain.
What was it like to be a child of the 50s? I mean, you literally grew up there. These formative young years in the 1950s, and as a historian yourself and me, when we teach about America in the 50s, it's a unique time, as all times are, but there's these kind of stereotypes attached to the 1950s. How can you describe what your experience was?
Yeah, that's interesting you ask, because I'm teaching that very thing right now in the Cold War, and I think the 50s... for me, it was a great time in the sense that everything, there was new inventions, and we had this great new thing called rock and roll music, which I really loved. I was a big fan of Elvis Presley and all of those kinds of things. And I believe late in the 50s, say the 57, 58, so I would have been in my early teen days, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, I remember really liking the rebellious nature of what teens were becoming. I bought in completely to Elvis Presley's ideas of long hair and doing what you wanted to do, not what your parents told you. Oh, I thought that was wonderful.
Now you thought then that Elvis was really projecting that he was singing it, he was moving that, he was, I mean, everything about his public persona was about this.
Yes, and I can remember great arguments in my family about whether or not his lower hips should be banned from television the way they were on Ed Sullivan. My parents mm-hmm. thinking it was wonderful and me thinking it was terrible.
That your parents think it was wonderful that it was
that it was banned. Oh, yeah. And me thinking that that was just stupid. You know, that was ridiculous. Why would they do that to this great man, this great singer? We had a lot of fights about Elvis Presley. We had a lot of fights about rock and roll music.
Could you listen to it in your home?
Yes, but it was kind of on our own time, and it was not where they could hear it and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Elvis was my sister liked him more than I did, but I think she liked him from a young teenage girl's
sure.
viewpoint. But I just liked him because he represented kind of a thumb in your nose at the adult sort of thing. And I used to go to all those rock and roll movies where the young people were, mm-hmm. you know, caught dancing and stuff. I thought that was so cool. Yeah, I loved every minute of that. And I think the rebellious 60s, which followed, I was really kind of part of that in the sense of at least I was a supporter of the ideas of rebellion, even though I didn't support the specific causes always. I thought it was really neat that we were kind of trying to take over the world ourselves and, mm-hmm. and telling, saying that the things that our parents represented were all wrong and old-fashioned and that they had that stupid Glenn Miller big band music and everything, and we didn't like any of that. We rejected all of that, and we had our own kind of music, and they hated it, and that was wonderful.
Who else did you listen to besides Elvis? Who else did you
If it was rock and roll, I listened to it, yeah. In the 50s, it was Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Conway Twitty before he became a country singer, and Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper, Gene Vincent. I mean, it was great. It was great music.
What about Little Richard?
Yes. I did like Little Richard, but I don't believe that we were exposed to as much of Little Richard's music as I would have liked to have been. In a few years, we will be exposed big time to the Motown sound, and I really enjoyed that. So, I think Little Richard was having less success in getting his music on the mainstream state rock and roll stations because he was black. But yeah, I like Little Richard, but I think that comes later for me when it's more acceptable than there in that beginning period when it really wasn't heard that much.
Right. Can you make any comments on what you saw, and you have a little bit before already, about segregation? And you mentioned what you saw in high school and Dearborn in general,
yeah.
But what about in the 1950s and of course, the 55 to 60 is really that time when the American Civil Rights Movement starts to kind of kick in.
Yeah. I remember it as a young teenager, I didn't understand the whole issue of segregation. I didn't understand it. I mean, I didn't understand why black people and white people weren't living in the same communities if they could both afford the same house. And I remember, generally speaking, hearing people say, well, you know, if the black people move in, then the property values go down.
Mm-hmm.
And it made no sense to me because if the black person could afford the house, then they could. Then why would the property value go down? If they had enough money, why would that be? I remember understanding class differences.
Mm-hmm.
I understood that you didn't want somebody who couldn't afford that house living in it because they would let the house go down and that would bring the neighborhood down. But I don't remember understanding why skin had anything to do with that. And I don't remember being taught that or being... I just remember that was a curious thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember also thinking that that the movement, the Martin Luther, because Martin Luther King was his movement was really starting then. And I can remember now and then he would come to the northern part of the country,
mm-hmm.
and he would say things like, "There's as much segregation up here as there is in the South."
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't really—I'd lived in Oklahoma, but there were no black people in Oklahoma. I don't remember there being that even being an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then in my town of Detroit, Michigan, there wasn't either. But yet on television, the things that I was seeing on television was that all the problems with black and white America were in Mississippi and Alabama and places like that, and yet I looked around in Detroit, Michigan, Dearborn, Michigan, and Detroit was black and Dearborn was white. Mm-hmm. And it always seemed to be strange to me that we as Northerners, because by that time living up there, we were so critical of the South, and yet just look around and we had this just as the same kind of segregation problems. Now, the South had voting problems and things like that the North didn't have. Right. But I remember the issue of segregation itself being that we had in a sense de facto up there and they didn't have that in the South. But I remember, I think it was a little bit of a double standard. I do remember thinking that.
You were conscious of that.
I was very conscious of it, yes. Okay. Yeah. But I didn't rub shoulders. I wasn't in high school with black students. Right. It wasn't until I went to the university that I started experiencing, you know, going to school with black mm-hmm. students.
Tell me about that. You were, like you said, you're both your parents are college educated, and so had been to that level of mm-hmm. education. You were, I guess, expected to kind of follow through with that.
Yes.
You felt comfortable with that. Tell me about the process of your senior year in high school and kind of selecting where you're going to go.
Yeah.
And with Maxine also, I guess, involved in this process.
Yeah, she had gone away to school herself. She was going to be a stewardess. They called them stewardesses then, a flight mm-hmm. attendant. She'd mm-hmm. gone to school in Minnesota during my senior year in high school. My parents were very much believers in the community college system. They were both products of a very good junior college mm-hmm. and our community college, as they called them, in Kansas. And Dearborn, Michigan had one of the finest community colleges in America, and it was called Henry Ford Community College. Mm-hmm. And I believe that I understood almost from the time I was a junior in high school that I would go there. I don't remember us ever having any discussions about me maybe going to Michigan or Michigan State or any of the universities to start, because my parents firmly believed that you got maybe even a better education at a good community college than you did at a large university where you were one of thousands and thousands instead of one of hundreds, and you had classes of 25 instead of classes of 250. So I don't remember there ever being an issue. Now, perhaps my grades are the reason that it never was an issue, because I was not I had a B average, I guess, and I'm not sure whether that I would have been able to get into the University of Michigan. But I did know that if I went to the Henry Ford Community College, I would do well there, and I did. So, but it was just sort of understood that's where I would go.
So you're there 63 to 65?
63 to 65, yes. Okay. And I got an associate's degree from there, Associate of Arts degree.
Okay. Do you have any memories or anything you want to comment upon your 2 years there?
It was a very solid 2 years. I think it really turned me on to education. I had great professors. I remember having having political science professors that were just incredible. They were lawyers, and they really understood. I remember being in political science class the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and having that next week become the focus. And I think that event probably turned me on to political science more than any other thing. And I from that moment on, even though I got a degree in business administration, virtually all of my elective courses were always taken in political science.
Tell me about that day. I was going to ask you about that. Just what do you remember?
I remember leaving my class and going out and listening, getting in my friend's car and them saying that the president had been assassinated, and then going home, and it was unbelievable. I mean, even my parents, who were not Kennedy supporters, were, you know, so bothered by us, because this is the first time it had happened in their lifetime. I remember the world coming to a halt. I remember the NFL shutting down the games on Sunday, I remember the NFL playing and the criticism associated with that. Mm-hmm. It happened on Friday afternoon, and then Saturday, Sunday, and then the funeral, I guess, was on Monday, or it may have been on Tuesday. But I remember being so impressed that all of the leaders of the world came to that funeral, even the Soviet Union. I mean, mean, it was just amazing. Charles de Gaulle standing there, and it was, you know, Kennedy, and Eisenhower, and everybody being there. And it was the first time that I'd seen the world come together that way, even after we had just gone through, you know, the missile crisis and all that kind of stuff the year before. Mm-hmm. But it's very much a vivid memory for me, and it was my freshman year of college.
What kind of long-term impact do you think that had upon you? You said it turned you on more and more.
It turned me on to the issue of politics in the sense that I saw educators dealing with the issue, and I thought to myself they would discuss the significance of it. I didn't take a lot of history classes in college because you had your choice. You could take history, you could take political science within the frame of my program, mm-hmm. and so I always chose political science instead. And but as a result of that, you have to have a historical background. So I did a lot of reading in history. But it really turned me on to politics more so than I had ever been before. Watching this change of the guard, President Johnson coming in, and then all the issues associated with changes of policies and everything was very. I became very much involved. In fact, that was November of 63. It was in May then of 64. When President Johnson announced the Great Society, and I went to hear him deliver that address at the University of Michigan's commencement.
You really?
Yeah, wow. My Maxine's sister was graduating, although she didn't graduate that day. She gave us her tickets and didn't even go through the ceremony, but we were there. We sat there and watched him deliver his Great Society address.
What was that like, seeing Johnson person, a Democrat? You know, for worse, but there's the president, and he's.
I would say that by this time, I don't want to say I've become a Democrat. That's too strong a word. But because I think I'm in school, I'm probably becoming more liberal in my thinking. I'm still living at home through those days.
Right.
But I was much more a supporter. I started thinking that Kennedy had done some good things in his including the Cuban Missile Crisis, his handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I gave him credit for that, and I gave him credit for it at the time. Mm-hmm. And then watching I thought he and Robert Kennedy both had the right idea on civil rights. I think.
Is this Ron today or Ron?
No, that's Ron then.
Okay,
absolutely. I was. Okay. I could feel myself changing in attitude. Just because I was paying attention, perhaps. I was a college student. I used to tend to be more liberal at the time, perhaps. But their approach to civil rights made sense to me. I mean, it really did. That we were, you know, students were going down there and trying to solve problems, trying to help blacks get registered to vote. Mm-hmm. Some of them dying in the process. All of that, I thought, was positive. And so when Kennedy was assassinated and Johnson took over, I was very much a supporter of President Johnson's ideas. And I think in the 64 election, I wasn't old enough to vote, but in the 64 election, had I had a vote, I would have voted for Johnson. And surprisingly, so did my father.
Really?
And it's one of those that, I mean, he has almost apologized to me that he believes that's one of the mistakes he made in his life was voting for Johnson instead of Goldwater.
Yeah. I would not have guessed that.
I know. He believed that Goldwater was some of those things that people said he was in terms of him being a warmonger, and not just about Vietnam, but about some of his other positions. So my dad never was, you know, he never bought into the conscience of the conservative idea from mm-hmm. the very beginning of him. My dad was also spending a lot of time in Texas in those days. And Lyndon was from Texas, and I think he had had a chance to meet Governor Connally. And mm-hmm. so I think he was kind of buying into, oh, yeah, he's a Democrat, but that Democrat is more like some of the Republicans up north.
Right.
It was a different kind of a party, and of course, ultimately, most of them became Republicans. But at the time, he was supportive of him, and I think I probably was too. I thought Lyndon Johnson's ideas on the Great Society were, some of those were positive. I thought Kennedy's Peace Corps was a good idea. I think we tend through our college days to be, you know, you get away from your parents, you start thinking on your own. But at the same time, I think my father was almost just like me in that sense too. Maybe he was changing a little bit too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ron, why don't we take a break?
Okay.
It happens from time to time. Mm-hmm. Okay, Ron, we're continuing now. After your 2 years there at Fort Community College, mm-hmm. what happened? Where did you go?
I went to Wayne State University. I don't remember whether I applied other places. My grades in community college were pretty good, better than I had done in high school, and I had shown that I was a serious student. And more importantly than that, I really enjoyed school. I enjoyed everything about it. I carried a full load, plus I went to summer school. And I worked two jobs. I worked at the National Bank of Detroit, and I was a playground director during the summer. So I was very busy, but I enjoyed every minute of it. And so I was pretty serious about school. Mm-hmm. I think I probably wanted to get a degree in political science, but my father was pretty insistent that political science, pretty clear to me that political scientists don't make much money.
Right.
And my dad was very much, he was a graduate of the School of Business, Kansas. Wayne State University had a very good business school, so affiliated with both General Motors and Ford Motor Company. Had a good program, and so I went to the School of Business. But every chance I got, every time they didn't say you had to take this course to get your degree in business, I took a political science class, mm-hmm. or I took the macroeconomics classes. I wasn't much on micro, but I loved the macro courses, and studied labor history, and actually ended up getting my degree in industrial relations. School of Business, but it was very people-oriented. It was the human resources side of business, so to speak, with a very strong political science background also.
When you say that you you loved school, what was it that you loved about it? Because that's unique. I haven't heard that a lot in my interviews, but mm-hmm. I also, as a teacher here, at Texas Tech, and you don't hear that a lot from
young
people.
I loved everything about it. I loved books. I loved reading. I loved studying. I loved research. I liked being in school. I loved campus life. Even though Wayne State University wasn't an urban university, so no one lived on campus.
Where did it look?
Downtown Detroit.
Right, mm-hmm.
right downtown. Mm-hmm. Known for its medical school, very fine medical school and a very fine law school and a good business school. But I was, I loved everything about it. I went to school every day and I hung out down at school and I stayed there and I just liked learning. It was a change for me because I went to a university that didn't have a sports program to speak of. I followed college sports and things like that, so I wasn't necessarily enjoying being a student at this university because it was Wayne State University. Mm-hmm. I think I would have felt that way anyway because I really enjoyed college life. Okay. And I think at that time probably there was a little bit of me that was saying, hey, I'd like to do this for the rest of my life, and there will be times in the next few years here where I will be going back to that idea of becoming a professor. It just took me a little bit longer than some people.
But you made it.
Ultimately.
Was Maxine with you at Wayne State, or where was she?
She came back from her flight attendant school and decided, and she was too young to become a flight attendant in those days, so she went to work for General Motors, mm-hmm. and she worked at General Motors in the communications department, and had a real good career there. And we ended up getting engaged while I was just finishing community college and in my junior year of the university. And then we got married when I turned 20. I was very young.
Did it have something to do with you turning 20?
I don't think so. I don't remember exactly why we even waited the year. We got engaged and waited another year, and we've been going together for 5 or 6 years. Maybe just because getting married at 19 sounded like too young. We got engaged at 19, got married at 20. And
in November or December?
We got married in September, Labor Day weekend of 1966. So I guess I was almost 21. Maybe that's what it was. I guess I turned 21 then in November of 40. That would have been 66, 45, yeah. So I was almost 21. So we got married, and then we continued. I still had school, and her place of business was just to the north side of about 2 miles north of Wayne State's campus, and she had a parking space in between. So we came in there every morning together, and we parked in her lot, and I walked south and she walked north, and we did that for another 2 years plus graduate school. So it was a good time.
And this was your graduate school?
Yes, I went to graduate school. I went through, got my master's bachelor's degree from Wayne State, and then I applied. I got it. I actually finished in June. I think I had some classes yet to take, but it was like June of 67, and I applied for graduate school in the School of Business, and they had a program where if you went summer, and then the whole year, and then summer, you can complete it in you could do a 2-year program in less than that. So I did that and got my master's degree in business administration in June of 1968.
This is shaping up very interesting because you're going to go to Vietnam shortly.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going to get into the Army very shortly here, and you have your MBA.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I had received my draft notice had come while I was still an undergraduate student. They had sent me this notice saying that my 2S deferment was going to be shifted to 1A. That would have been in 67, and that I would be eligible for the draft, and that I could expect to be called shortly thereafter. At the time, they had just come up, and they just did this for 2 years, I believe, 67 and 68. They came up with what they called the Selective Service Qualifying Test. And if you wanted to go to graduate school or to law school, maybe to medical school, you had to take this test, even though you would already would have had to take the GRE or the GMAT or the LSAT or whatever. You'd have to take all those to get into graduate school anyway. But the military had its own test that Princeton University devised for it, the SSQT. And I remember so I applied to take that so that I could go to graduate school. And I remember them sending me my, filling out the forms, sending it off, and I had requested that I would take it at the University of Michigan Dearborn campus, which was just not too far from us. And the form came back, and I didn't pay much attention to it. I thought that I got my first choice or whatever. And the next morning, I remember getting up to drive to 30 minutes and looking on my card, and it said, "You're taking the test at the University of Michigan Flint campus," which was, instead of being 30 minutes away, it was about 2.5 hours away. And I remember getting in the car and just driving breakneck speed all the way down the freeway, I-75 north out of Detroit, hoping that I could get to the University of Michigan's Flint campus in time to take that exam, knowing that everything is on the line here. Not only do I have to pass the test, but I got to get there to take it. And so we raced up there, and I sat down and took that exam with all the pressure of the world on my shoulders. I felt like that I had to score high enough, and I guess I did, because they allowed me to keep my 2S deferment.
And this was in 1960?
This is I took that exam in, I believe, the fall of 67. No, I must have taken it in the spring of 67. Because I started graduate school in the fall of 67. I actually started in the summer and then in the fall and then in the spring of 68. With the understanding that I would become 1A again and eligible for the draft as soon as I completed my MBA. Then the Army had a deal where they had what they call a college options program. And that is that you, if you knew you were going to be drafted, you could ask the Army to delay your induction until you had completed your degree. And in my case, it would be 4 months. And then at that time, you could go in immediately. And if you wanted to join the college option program, they would guarantee you a spot in OCS. And they only did this, I believe, for those universities that did not have ROTC programs. Mm-hmm. And my university did not have an ROTC program, so I elected to enlist under the college option plan.
Okay. Tell me then, Ron, and let's go back for a moment in time. When were you first conscious of the United States doing anything in Southeast Asia? Well, that's maybe too general. In regards to what became the Vietnam War for the United States, that we obviously had dealings in Southeast Asia before, but post-World War II, when were you first conscious of this? Was this during the 50s in Eisenhower, or was it the election of 1960?
I don't remember ever being conscious of anything that dealt with military issues until the Cuban Missile Crisis of October of 1962.
Okay.
I was a senior in high school. It's so vivid in my mind. I just got done teaching this too, but it's so vivid in my mind because I remember that we had already gone through the evening thing with Kennedy coming on television, and I remember the Adlai Stevenson speech when he was going to confront the Soviet Union,
yes,
at the United, yes, Nations, and I remember
the hell freezes over speech.
Right, the hell freezes over speech. I remember that speech was in the morning, and I had my transistor radio. I took it to school, and I wanted to listen to Stevenson's speech in my English class, and I could not understand how our English professor, our English teacher, Mr. Cummins, who was teaching us the Return of the Native, great boring English novels that you have to read, and I remember thinking how stupid it was that we were sitting in this class talking about the Return of the Navy, Return of the Native, when Stevenson was going to be on and confront the Soviet Union with those pictures, and we weren't allowed to listen to it. And I remember my wife, my now wife, my then girlfriend, was living in Minnesota at the time, and I remember writing her a letter, and I think she still has that letter, where I say that I know I'm going to join the Army. I'm going to, as soon as, you know, whether I have to wait a lot of schools out. I was only 17, so I wouldn't have been able to do it anyway, but mm-hmm. I may drop out of high school and go join the Army. I'm going to go fight those Russians. I remember thinking that because I totally had bought into the whole idea of what was going on, mm-hmm. even though infantry soldiers would be the last thing that we'd need if that thing hadn't worked out the way it did. It wasn't going to be much of an issue. But I do remember being so upset with Mr. Cummins that he didn't think it was important enough.
He announced that to the class?
I had my radio, and I said, Mr. Cummins, Adlai Stevenson speaking at 9 o'clock. You know, we got there at like 9 o'clock, and he was coming on, and I said, And he said, no, we're going to talk about Return of the Native. You can read about it in the newspaper. And I just didn't understand that. I just didn't understand how what we were about. I mean, I had classes where we were allowed to listen to the World Series, and this was so important. But he was an English teacher. May have been a different class, but we couldn't listen to it. So I had to wait and find out what happened later. But that was my first thinking that I, as an adult, was going to be involved in some of this. But I don't remember it being, oh, this is about, it wasn't about Vietnam, it was about those bad Russians, what they had done.
You were well on your way to becoming a history geek and a history professor.
I think probably so. I had it with the English department anyway. But I, But then when I went to Wayne State University, which was an incredible, a very liberal university, urban university, I remember Vietnam becoming an issue. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, I remember watching the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution on television, coming home from church that morning, watching it at my parents' house.
The vote.
Yes. Yeah, the actual vote. It was on a Sunday. Now, let's see, the incident was, now I'm forgetting whether the Sunday was the incident and the vote came later, but I remember it being, I remember Johnson being on television on Sunday afternoon. Anyway.
I believe the incident was on that Sunday.
You think it was on a Sunday, then the announcement was, and then the vote was like Tuesday or Wednesday. But anyway, I remember all of that, and so when I went to Wayne State, then I do remember demonstrations, I remember people coming on campus and going to listen to them. I went to everything. I was very much a student who no matter what my view was, I'd hear the other side. And I remember going and listening to Herbert Aptheker's speech, talk about Vietnam. And I remember seeing Cesar Chavez come on campus when no one even really knew who he was. It was before the Gallo strikes and everything. I was there the day that H. Rapp Brown gave a speech and pointed to the flag and said, "That ain't my flag, baby." That was at our campus.
Did you hear that?
I was there. It was on the cover of Time magazine. Yes. And so I was a witness to history of all of that. I was very active. I was active as a spectator. I didn't join any clubs. I didn't participate. I did work a little bit on the 68 campaign of Governor Romney when he ran for president, but basically I was a spectator to all of this.
And but Ron, you are incredibly, you're describing an individual who's incredibly politically and historically conscious. I mean, who not only wants to be involved and see these things, but understands the significance at the same time that you want to listen to Stevenson because it's historically significant, right, and it's important in the day. That's very unique.
And I think that came from my father. I mean, my dad's like that today. I mean, if something happened at 10 o'clock this morning, my dad will know about it, he'll read about it, and he'll get on the phone and tell everybody about it. That's just the way our family was, at least my father. Uh-huh. I just remember... And I remember thinking that probably, I don't remember thinking that, gee whiz, I'll probably do this someday, because my goodness, 64, 65, I don't go in until 68. I watched about the war, I watched everything about it. I don't remember having real strong opinions about it. I mean, I'm sure I did. But I don't remember, I remember just being a sponge
even
for all the information.
Even when there's a good possibility that you might have to go? Or did not, did
I remember, yeah,
the equation?
I remember feeling that if my country is fighting this war, that there's a strong chance, since I'm of draft age and draft and my classification is correct, there's a strong possibility that I might end up doing that. On the other hand, you know, I was talking to recruiters, looking at what my options might be, and most all of them were telling me, "Oh, with an MBA, you've got a good chance of getting in the Army and being in the Finance Corps or the Adjutant General of the Adjutant General Corps in Personnel. S1's got you written all over it, or S4. I don't think I ever thought I'd fight in the war, because I sort of knew that not everybody that went over there fought, and you would hear about people that, you know, never got out of Saigon and stuff.
Right.
So I think I probably believed that with my education, my advanced education, that I'd have a good chance at doing something that was more in line with what I did. Because after all, my father,
yes,
was a supply officer. My dad had enlisted and gone to Harvard. My dad went to the Harvard School of Business to get his, after he got his commission, mm-hmm, he had a direct commission, and then he went to the Harvard School of Business and learned how to do all that supply stuff. So I thought, wow, you know, that's probably what will happen to me, too.
Let me play devil's advocate. What about the growing up, the Cowboys and Indians side of you, the adventurous side of Ron? Was that part of your consciousness?
That comes a little later when I enlist, and I'm to this college option program mm-hmm. that I mentioned. And they tell me this is, I enlisted in I believe, November or December of 67. At least I don't know that I put my name in the dotted line, but I was sure I was going after having tried to get in the Air Force and the Navy. My math background wasn't strong enough to become a line officer in the Navy, and that's all they were taking in the Naval OCS.
Now, let me mm-hmm. ask you, when were you trying to... Was this because of your dad, Navy?
Yeah, I think so.
Was this during the MBA time?
It was while I was in graduate school, yeah.
Okay, so you're looking ahead, going, okay, when I get out, I know...
Something's going to happen.
So let me choose the branch, and let me choose kind of where I want to go. So tell me about the Navy. What was it?
The Navy, I think, because the OCS was in Rhode Island. It sounded exciting. My dad had been in. I'd grown up on Victory at Sea, all those great 50s films and music and everything. The Navy was, I even rooted for the Navy and the Army-Navy game and stuff. I mean, I was a Navy guy, even though my dad had only been in a few years. I was a Navy guy. So I applied, and my background in mathematics and sciences was not strong enough for what the Navy was wanting at the time for admittance to OCS. I don't know that I ever took the examination. I may have. If I did, I probably didn't do well on it. That's a little murky in my mind right now as to whether I was rejected because I didn't score well or whether they looked at my transcripts and said, there's no point you don't have the necessary education to become a line officer. And there was no supply jobs because the Navy was everybody wanted in the Navy during the Vietnam War, and so they said, okay, we'll take line officers only. And so I did apply, or I did something, and was not allowed to join the Navy. So then my next choice was the Air Force. And my eyes were not good enough to be a pilot.
Why the Air Force?
Because it wasn't the Army. And it wasn't the Marines.
What was the last choice? Was it Marines?
Yeah, probably. The Air Force wouldn't take me because my eyes, I couldn't be a pilot, but my eyes were good enough to be a navigator. So I went down and took the physical for the Air Force, and they found out I had a heart, tachycardia, that my heart rate was too fast. And so I went down to the medical, so they said, you can come back and take it in 2 months or something. So I went down to the medical center at Wayne State University, and I said to the people in the one of the nurses there, I said, look, I have to take this electrocardiogram test. Mm-hmm. And I said, the one I took down at AFES was... it showed my heart rate was too fast, and I think it's because I have this nervousness when people start hooking me up to things. So I said, would you let me lay here a while and almost like fall asleep, and then you hook that thing up to me? And they did, and I passed, and I got whatever medical issues were uh-huh. taken care of. Well, then the Tet Offensive comes. And the Air Force is no longer interested because everybody wants in the Air Force. They don't need any navigators. And so...
Why do you think everybody wanted in the Air Force?
Because it wasn't the Army or the Marines.
And you weren't going to be trapped at Quezon. You weren't going to be
right.
on the ground.
Right, yeah. So I went to the Army. And I started looking into this OCS thing that they had. And the OCS thing said that... at the time when I first applied, they said they had all these OCSs around the country. They had one in Fort Benjamin Harrison, Indiana, and you could become a member of the you could go into the HR branch, essentially, out of that. They had Fort Belvoir for logistics people. Mm-hmm. All those looked really good to me. So I made my list of choices. This was in, like, December, January. And I made my choice. I said, okay, I want to go to Fort Benjamin Harrison OCS, become an S1. And if that doesn't work out, I'll go to be an S4 supply guy like my dad was. Mm-hmm. And then the Tet Offensive occurs. And I think I'd already signed on the dotted line over Christmas, because I'm going to be graduating in June of 68 right. with my MBA. And so about the middle of February, just a couple of weeks after the Tet Offensive, I get a phone call from my recruiter saying that there has been a major change, and that the all of the, as a result, he said as a result of the Tet Offensive, I've tried to research this to see if he was telling me the truth, I'm not sure exactly, but he said as a result of the Tet Offensive, there is a, they're going to close down all of the non-combat arm OCSs, and everybody must go to armor, artillery, engineering, or infantry, and that if you want to go into the adjutant general corps or the logistics people, supply corps, if you want to go in those, you absolutely have to go to infantry OCS. And that then the Army will choose, if you go to infantry OCS, the Army will then take the top three graduates, not the top 3%, but the top three graduates of each OCS company and give them their first choice. And if you graduate in the top three, you can choose Adjutant General Corps, mm-hmm. and you can become the S1. But that's the only way that you can do it. So we had a lot of searching to do, soul searching about this. This was different than what I had thought. I thought I was automatic finance corps, automatic adjutant corps, something. Mm-hmm. MBA, that's what they had all told me. Mm-hmm.
How did you feel?
Well, I was concerned then, because, you know, we're watching the Tet Offensive on television,
right.
and we're seeing guys dying right and left. Something like 500 dead in that week of the first 2 weeks of February of 68. Lots of guys being killed. I mean, and probably maybe then, the memory of Cowboys and Indians and Leslie Blanchett and Leslie Blanchett's dad and everything starts coming in, and I start thinking, well, I can do this. I'll go to infantry OCS. I'll graduate in the top three. But even if I don't, if I become an infantry officer, I can do it. I can handle this. So I allowed myself to be, I mean, I enlisted with the complete understanding. They also had this thing I was hearing about, and I think maybe the sergeant even told me this, a recruiting NCO probably even may have said this, that, you know, you can go to OCS, and you'll go basic AIT, and then you'll go 6 months to OCS, and then you'll have been in for 10, 11 months by that time. You can turn down your commission. And you'll just then have a year to serve. Now, you still will probably go to Vietnam, but, you know, you'll only have the year. You can make that choice later on, mm-hmm. if you choose that this isn't what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking then to my parents about it. And I believe at that time, my mom was very worried. I don't know how I knew that exactly, but I sort of sensed that this was real war, and that it bothered her. And that bothered me, that it bothered her. I don't remember if I was in her eyes or exactly what, but I remember sensing that this was going to be a hard thing for her. It's going to be hard for my father, too, but he'd been in uniform, and he understood war. But for mothers, it's different, I think. And that bothered me. My wife, you know, we'd been married for 2 years.
Any kids?
No. And she was working at GM, and she'd have to, while I went in, she'd have to go live with her parents or something. And I remember that bothering her. But I also don't ever remember there being any question about doing it. I mean, we looked at all the options, and at that point, The Army, the Navy was out of the question. The Air Force was out of the question. The Marines I'd never even considered. And the Army was going to be what it was going to be. Or the other two, the only other two options we thought we had were going to Canada, which was easy because it was in, we lived in Detroit. We just walk across the bridge and you're there. That was an option. Or jail.
I'm sorry, or?
Or jail.
Okay.
I don't remember there being any other options. And Canada, we rejected Canada immediately. I was not going to leave my country. So the only option to me was going in or going to jail. I don't ever remember thinking about, well, maybe I can go blow my knee out. I don't remember thinking that maybe I can get a doctor right excuse. I had hay fever. I even, when I went through took my physical, they found out I was somewhat night blind. I had a night blindness problem. Why not, you know, if a guy's got problems with night blindness, why not put him in the infantry? I remember thinking that was a little bit strange.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember thinking that about that time, maybe the adventurous side of me starts kicking in, and I start saying, I can do this.
Because you accepted your fate?
I had accepted my fate. I had everything that I had asked my government to do for me, they had allowed me to. They had allowed me to get my MBA. They had allowed me to try these other branches and see if that worked, and that didn't. They had played with me as far as extending my 2S deferment until I finished everything. So I wasn't particularly mad at them. They'd done their part. My draft board stayed out of my, you know, I'd written letters to my draft board. I still have copies of those. Letters to my draft board saying, please allow me to finish my degree and all this stuff. They'd done everything that I'd asked them to do. So now it was my turn, you know, time for me to make the decision as to what I wanted to do. And I don't remember us giving it a lot of thought other than, well, our time has come and I'll go do this.
This seems like a very, very well thought out process for you, that you explored A, B, C, D, and then under A, subset 1, 2, 3. I mean, you really...
Pretty much.
And you and Maxine doing this as a team?
Yeah, we were. It was, her family was very active in the anti-war movement.
Really?
Incredibly so.
Well, this is at this time. I mean,
yes, oh yeah, yeah. Her sister was a graduate of the University of Michigan, was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. Her other sister was married to a guy who was a true draft dodger, was ready to go to Canada, didn't, but would have.
Mm-hmm.
His parents were very wealthy and were funding anti-war movement. They would rent buses and take students from Ann Arbor to Washington for all of the rallies. So they were active in the anti-war movement. Her father was not a veteran. He was built tanks, I believe, during World War II there in Dearborn. There was no military experience in that family. Three girls, so none of the boys were none of her. She had two sisters, so there was no men facing the draft, and so. But she supported everything I was trying to do, or everything we looked at it as a we, and she was very supportive of me. I don't remember her having an opinion about the war, but I do remember her having a strong opinion about soldiers, and that was that she was very supportive of them. And I don't think I can say that necessarily about her family. I don't remember that I don't remember that they were specifically saying things about why would you do this, but I remember that she felt like there was a questioning on their part about why I am electing to do what I'm about to do.
There was or was not?
Was. From her family.
Right.
But not from her, because she was part of the decision process.
Have you talked to her about that? Since.
Oh yeah, and we've talked to her family about it, and some of my memories of what I think their perception of me at the time are probably, they're now saying, oh no, we didn't feel that way and stuff, but they did. My own feeling is, based on things that I remember, was that because they were so active in the anti-war movement, they could not understand why anybody would go in. her sister had also been married to a man. I think they were divorced by then, but I think she was married to a guy who had been in the reserves, and so he had gone to Fort Benning to take his reserve training, and she had gone with him and been a teacher down in there. So she knew Benning, she knew the military, and they were not real supportive of military things. They were very negative about his experiences having been down at Fort Benning, and that's about where I was going to be end up going.
So I
remember it as being a time when we felt very much alone, the two of us, on this decision. Dad supported it. Mom was a mom. But we didn't see a lot of options, and we said, well, okay, well, let's go do it.
Did you have communication directly with Maxine's family?
Oh, yeah. They both lived in Dearborn there.
Were they trying to say, you know, Ron, what are you doing? Don't do this. You're making a mistake.
Not to me directly, okay. But I think through her they questioned why I was going to do what a lot of guys weren't doing. And I don't even remember thinking, hey, all my friends have done, all my buddies are getting out of this. Why am I going? I don't remember that a lot of people were having to go. I don't remember my college friends were having to go. I think it seems like everybody had a reason why they couldn't go, medical or otherwise. Mm-hmm. I just don't remember my other friends having to go. And even to this day, we always say about how come I was the only one of a circle of people that went.
Experiencing you, I can actually feel right now in this room, the vacuum in which you and Maxine, you just described you all living.
Yeah, we very much felt alone in that process. My sister's husband had been drafted. He had gone to Vietnam. He was a clerk in Saigon. But by this time, by the time that I'm electing to go, I'm trying to think he was in Vietnam at the time.
Mm-hmm. Had you had communication with him?
I saw him for a couple of weeks before I went in. And he was very boastful about his service in Vietnam as a clerk. We now think he lied about everything because he later divorced her. He will divorce her before I go to Vietnam. He was a clerk who you would think had won, the Medal of Honor fighting the VC in the streets of Saigon. And I don't believe any of that happened because we found out later that he was a perpetual liar who lied about not only that, but everything else in his life up to that time. So that was about the only person that I knew had gone to Vietnam, and his MOS was a clerk. He was questioning why I was going to become an officer because he didn't like officers. So he was critical of me for going. But we didn't have any other friends. We didn't know anybody that had done it. There was nobody saying, yeah, this is a great idea. I know no one said that. I think my father reluctantly said, well, if you have to, you have to. But I don't remember him having a strong opinion one way or the other than accepting my decision. And like I say, I think I could just look at my mother's eyes and know that she wasn't real happy about this, mm-hmm. as I wouldn't be if it were my son now. I mean, I understand that parents is a whole different situation. But I do remember, and I think they also thought that this was summer of 68 that I actually went in, and my goodness, we'd been fighting for 3 years. This thing can't go on forever. Even World War II was over in 4. And I think maybe we even thought that a little bit. Summer of 68. Why would you think that since I'm enlisting for 3 years, and chances are pretty good that if I do basic and AIT and OCS, there's 10 months and then you leave in between. There's a year, and then we knew that once you get commissioned, you're going to get some time in country before you go. why would we think this war would continue for what has to be at least another year and a half before I go? Johnson's already decided not to run. Nixon's got a secret plan to end the war.
Negotiations have started in Paris?
No, not quite. Negotiations in Paris, I don't think, started until November. The announcement that there might be some, but Johnson gets out on March 31st of 68, so I go in July. It was November when this talking starts. And I was in AIT by that time. But there's a sense that we're moving. We've stopped the drop. We've stopped the bombing. You know, bombing pauses had come and gone. And so we feel, as a young man going in, I could certainly feel that maybe there's a chance this thing will be over before I have to go. And if I end up having to go into the infantry, at least maybe it will be over. The real fighting will be over by the time I get there. So perhaps that made my parents feel better, and maybe that's what her family felt too. Maybe they felt like probably it would be over.
You sense from her family that they were actually worried about you individually?
I don't know if I sensed that or not. I probably didn't sense that. I was probably a little bit of feeling that they weren't very supportive, therefore they were against it. And knowing their anti-war attitudes, I'm not sure I even sought their approval.
Right.
So there may have been a little bit of a reluctance for me to ask too many questions about how they felt. But at the time, they knew their daughter was going to come back and live with them, which she did for that first part. And they probably liked that part. And so I think it was just a matter of go do what you have to do. And I got my orders to go to basic.
Why don't we stop here?
That's a good time. That's a good time.